rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One is offered as a podcast at rte.ie/drama on one and, of course, here on RTE Radio 1 on Sunday nights. This month, we've been listening to a season of Samuel Beckett's writings, including What, All That Fall, The Old Tune, and a special edition of Bowman's Sunday 8:30 focused on Beckett's life and work. Tonight's featured work is a piece of monologue. Each work is introduced by Jerry Dukes, whose stage adaptation with Barry McGovern of Beckett's post-war trilogy of novels, As I'll Go On, has played around the world. Jerry is also editor of Samuel Beckett, First Love and Other Novellas, and author of the biography Samuel Beckett from Penguin's Illustrated Lives series. Tonight, Jerry focuses on a piece of monologue by Samuel Beckett, first performed in 1979.
I think it would be true to say that the people who inhabit Beckett's writing, the characters who inhabit Beckett's writings, are as chronologically gifted as he is. He grows old with them, so to speak. Crap's Last Tape. Beckett wrote that play for a particular actor, Patrick McGee. In fact, while he was writing it, he called it the McGee Monologue. The title of the play comes later. So he was animated or driven to writing a play by the particular sound of a particular actor. And this happened to him again in the late 70s when he wrote a monologue for an actor called David Warrilow, an English actor. Beckett had encountered his work when Warrilow was connected to an American theatre company that had toured extensively in Europe, Mabu Mimes, and he became very friendly with the leader of that company, a man called Joe Chaykin. The last thing that Beckett wrote, it's a prose piece, it's called What is the Word? Having written it, he dedicated it to Joe Chaykin because Chaykin had suffered a heart attack. And when he recovered, he didn't recover fully. He suffered aphasia. He couldn't speak. So What is the Word was something that he was looking for all the time to utter. I've no idea what Joe Chaykin thought of it, but it is a magnificent piece. A piece of monologue begins, the first line is very simple, birth was the death of him. Now, that is a cliche, of course it is, but it is more than just a cliche. It resonates in all kinds of directions in the context, because this is a stage play, not just a radio, it's a stage play. The actor doesn't move during the play, he just stands there and speaks. There's a low level of lighting. The actor is downstage left. There's a lamp with a globe, center stage, dimly lit. And there is a suggestion of a bed end on stage right, which is white to catch the light, just like the actor is dressed in bed socks and a bedgown and has white hair. So everything is, well, let's put it like this, everything is grey on stage. And it's a slow fade up and it's a slow fade down at the end. And the piece is short. It takes a long time to speak. It is birth was the death of him. And then there are a number of moments in the play which echo other moments in Beckett's work. One of the things that comes into the play is there's a recollection in the speech of a wall upon which was affixed many years ago loads and loads of photographs of loved ones, of family members, of the speaker himself. But over the years, these have been ripped from the wall, torn into shreds. Some of them have left their thumbtacks in the wall still. But there is the suggestion that as one ages, the gradual stripping away of memory, of connections with loved ones, all of these things happen. So this is a play that encapsulates all of that, all of those deplorable developments in our endings into a kind of threnody, a lament in prose. And it is an extraordinarily powerful thing. And it doesn't go very far. There's a bed, a window, a wall, a lamp. There is three accounts of lighting the lamp. The third one is of a memory of somebody else lighting the lamp with a spill. The first two are done with matches, which of course would be normal enough in the 20th century, but the spill suggests a pre-electric time, and the spill would come from another source of light or heat somewhere else. We use matches to light our candles now, not spills. Beckett remembers, and he stitches this into the memory of the speaker. So it is, as I say, it's a threnody, a lament for something that is coming to a close. We will never be conscious of our ending. This is something he had exploited before in the play. One of the notions that informs the play is that the last moment of human consciousness might in fact be infinite, that it doesn't end, despite being boxed and put away. That's a cheery note on which to end.
Jerry Dukes there, and Jerry will be back later in the programme to remember his meetings with Samuel Beckett. Jerry was speaking to Kevin Brew, and Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Next, the play itself. This is a piece of monologue by Samuel Beckett, performed by Barry McGovern and directed by Daniel Reardon.
Birth was the death of him. Again, words are few. Dying too. Birth was the death of him. Ghastly grinning ever since, up at the lid to come, in cradle and crib. At suck, first fiasco, with the first totters, from mammy to nanny and back, all the way, bandied back and forth. So ghastly grinning on, from funeral to funeral, to now, this night, 2.5 billion seconds. Again, 2.5 billion seconds. Hard to believe so few. From funeral to funeral. Funerals of, he all but said, of loved ones. 30,000 nights. Hard to believe so few. Born dead of night, sun long sunk behind the larches, new needles turning green. In the room dark gaining, till faint light from standard lamp, wick turned low. And now, this night, up at nightfall, every nightfall, faint light in room, whence unknown, none from window, now, next to none, no such thing as none, gropes to window and stares out. Stands there staring out, stock still staring out. Nothing stirring in that black vast. Gropes back in the end to where the lamp is standing. Was standing when last went out. Loose matches in right hand pocket. Strikes one on his buttock the way his father taught him. Takes off milk-white globe and sets it down. Match goes out. Strikes a second as before. Takes off chimney, smoke-clouded. Holds it in left hand. Match goes out. Strikes a third as before and sets it to wick. Puts back chimney. goes out. Puts back globe. Turns wick low. Backs away to edge of light and turns to face east. Plank wall. So nightly. Up, socks, nightgown, window, lamp. Backs away to edge of light and stands facing blank wall. Covered with pictures once. Pictures of, he all but said, of loved ones. Unframed, unglazed, pinned to wall with drawing pins, all shapes and sizes, down one after another, gone, torn to shreds and scattered, strewn all over the floor, not at one sweep, no sudden fit of, no word. Ripped from the wall and torn to shreds one by one, over the years, years of nights. Nothing on the wall now but the pins. Not all. Some out with the wrench. Some still pinning a shred. So stands there facing blank wall. Dying on. No more, no less, no, less, less to die, ever less, like light at nightfall. Stands there facing east, blank pinpocked surface once white in shadow. Could once name them all, there was father. That grey void. Their mother. That other. There together, smiling, wedding day. There all three. That grey blot. There alone. He alone. So on. Not now. Forgotten. All gone so long. Gone. Ripped off and torn to shreds. Scattered all over the floor. Swept out of the way under the bed and left. Thousand shreds under the bed with the dust and spiders. All the... He all but said, the loved ones. Stands there facing the wall, staring beyond. Nothing there either. Nothing stirring there either. Nothing stirring anywhere. Nothing to be seen anywhere. Nothing to be heard anywhere. Room once full of sounds. Faint sounds, whence unknown. Fewer and fainter as time wore on, nights wore on. None now, no, no such thing as none. Rain some nights still slant against the panes, or dropping gentle on the place beneath, even now. Lamp smoking though wick turned low. Strange. Faint smoke issuing through vent in globe. Low ceiling stained by night after night of this. Dark shapeless blot on surface elsewhere white. Once white. Stands facing wall after the various motions described. That is, up. At nightfall and into gown and socks. No. In them already. In them all night. All day. All day and night. Up at nightfall in gown and socks, and, after a moment to get his bearings, gropes to window. Faint light in room, unutterably faint, whence unknown. Stands stock still, staring out into black vast. Nothing there, nothing stirring that he can see. Here, dwells thus as if unable to move again, or no will left to move again, not enough will left to move again. Turns in the end and gropes to where he knows the lamp is standing. Thinks he knows, was last standing, when last went out. Match 1 as described for globe, 2 for chimney, 3 for wick. Chimney and globe back on, turns wick low. Backs away to edge of light and turns to face wall, east. Still as the lamp by his side. Gown and socks white to take faint light. Once white. Hair white to take faint light. Foot of pallet just visible edge of frame. Once white to take faint light. Stands there staring beyond. Nothing. Empty dark. Till first word always the same. Night after night the same. Birth. Then slow fade up of a faint form. Out of the dark. A window. Looking west. Sun long sunk behind the larches. Light dying. Soon none left to die. No. No such thing as no light. Starless, moonless heaven. Dies on to dawn and never dies. There in the dark, that window. Night slowly falling. Eyes to the small pane gaze at that first night. Turn from it in the end to face the darkened room. There in the end, slowly, a faint hand. Holding aloft a lighted spill. In light of spill, faintly, the hand and milk-white globe. Then second hand, in light of spill, takes off globe and disappears, reappears empty, takes off chimney. Two hands and chimney in light of spill. Spill to wick, chimney back on, hand with spill disappears, second hand disappears. Chimney alone in gloom. Hand reappears with globe. Globe back on. Turns wick low. Disappears. Pale globe alone in gloom. Glimmer of brass bedrail. Fade. Birth, the death of him. That nevoid smile. 30,000 nights. Stands at edge of lamplight, staring beyond. Into dark, whole again. Window gone. Hands gone. Light gone. Gone. Again and again. Again and again gone, till dark slowly parts again. Grey light, rain pelting, umbrellas round a grave, seen from above, streaming black canopies, black ditch beneath, rain bubbling in the black mud, empty for the moment. That place beneath. Which, he all but said, which loved one. 30 seconds to add to the 2.5 billion odd, then fade. Dark, whole again. Blessed dark. No. No such thing as whole. Stands staring beyond, half hearing what he's saying. He? The words falling from his mouth, making do with his mouth. Lights lamp, as described. Backs away to edge of light and turns to face wall. Stares beyond into dark. Waits for first word, always the same. It gathers in his mouth. Parts lips and thrusts tongue forward. Birth. Parts the dark. Slowly, the window. That first night, the room, the spill, the hands, the lamp, the gleam of brass, fade, gone, again and again, again and again, gone. Mouth agape, a cry, stifled by nasal, dark parts, grey light, rain pelting, streaming umbrellas, ditch, bubbling black mud, coffin out of frame, whose, fade, gone. Move on to other matters. Try to move on to other matters. How far from wall? Head almost touching, as at window. Eyes glued to pane, staring out. Nothing stirring. Black vast. Stands there stock still, staring out, as if unable to move again, or gone the will to move again. Gone. Faint cry in his ear, mouth agape, closed with hiss of breath. Lips joined. Feel soft touch of lip on lip. Lip lipping lip. Then parted by cry as before. Where is he now? Back at window, staring out. Eyes glued to pain, as if looking his last. Turns away at last, and gropes through faint unaccountable light to unseen lamp. White gown moving through that gloom. Once white. Lights and moves to face wall as described. Head almost touching. Stands there staring beyond, waiting for first word. It gathers in his mouth. Birth. Parts lips and thrusts tongue between them. Tip of tongue. Feels soft touch of tongue on lips, of lips on tongue. Fade up in outer dark of window. Stare beyond through rift in dark to other dark, further dark, sun long sunk behind the larches, nothing stirring, nothing faintly stirring, stock still, eyes glued to pain, as if looking his last at that first night of 30,000 odd. Turn away in the end to darkened room where soon to be, this night to be, spill, hands, lamp, gleam of brass, pale globe alone in gloom, brass bedrail catching light. 30 seconds to swell the 2.5 billion odd. Fade. Gone. Cry, snuffed with breath of nostrils, again and again. Again and again, gone. Till whose grave? Which? He all but said, which loved ones? He? Black ditch in pelting rain, way out through the grey rift in dark, seen from on high, streaming canopies, bubbling black mud, coffin on its way. Loved one, he all but said, loved one on his way, her way. 30 seconds, fade, gone. Stands there staring beyond, into dark, whole again. No, no such thing as whole. Head almost touching wall. White hair catching light, white gown, white socks, white foot of pallet, edge of frame, stage left. Once white, least give, and head rests on wall. But no, stock still, head haught, staring beyond, nothing stirring, faintly stirring, 30,000 nights of ghosts beyond, beyond that black beyond, ghost light, ghost nights, ghost rooms, ghost graves, ghost. He all but said, ghost loved ones, waiting on the rip word. Stands there staring beyond at that black veil, lips quivering to half-heard words, treating of other matters, trying to treat of other matters, till half hears there are no other matters. Never were other matters, never two matters, never but the one matter, the dead and gone, the dying and the going, from the word go, the word be gone, such as the light going now, beginning to go, in the room. Where else? Unnoticed by him staring beyond. The globe alone. Not the other, the unaccountable. From nowhere. On all sides, nowhere. Unutterably faint. The globe alone. Alone, gone.
You've been listening to a piece of monologue by Samuel Beckett, performed by Barry McGovern and directed by Daniel Reardon. Mark Dwyer was on sound. The producer was Kevin Reynolds. The Drama on One Beckett season was made possible by kind permission of the estate of Samuel Beckett. To listen back to a piece of monologue and the entirety of the Beckett season, have a look at rte.ie/drama on one.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Next, a closer look at Samuel Beckett. In addition to providing expert commentaries to our Beckett season, Jerry Dukes has been remembering his own meetings with the writer on numerous occasions in the 1980s. It all began with the world premiere at the Gate Theatre in 1985 of I'll Go On, Jerry's stage adaptation with Barry McGovern of Beckett's post-war trilogy of novels.
I shall not watch myself die. That would spoil everything. Have I watched myself live?
Barry invited me to participate in making a script for I'll Go On. Some months beforehand, we had decided that the so-called post-war trilogy of novels, Malloy, Malone Dies and The Unnameable, would be the source for the script.
Have I ever complained? Then why rejoice now?
Now, obviously, there's some 400 pages in this. The template we had been given by Michael Colgan, who was producing, was a little bit constraining.
I am content, necessarily, but not to the point of clapping my hands.
So the first act would be 50 minutes, and the second act would be 40 minutes. So, as I've written somewhere else, there we were with the ocean of Beckett's incomparable prose before us, and two thimbles in our hands.
I was always content, knowing I would be repaid. While waiting, I shall tell myself stories, if I can.
The way to read Beckett is to read Beckett, but of course this was not reading, this was listening to Beckett in the theatre, and you couldn't have anybody doing 400 pages. But it worked. It worked very well. I'll Go On has travelled the world.
I look forward to their giving me great satisfaction. Some satisfaction. I am satisfied. There, I have enough. I am repaid. I need nothing more.
Barry and I got together in June 1985. And then eventually we finalised the script. I hadn't found a way to begin it.
Let me say before I go any further that I forgive nobody.
I was going on holidays to the south of France, and then I contrived to get a flat in Paris for a couple of weeks on the way back and wrote to Beckett in the hope that he would meet me and I could consult with him. But that didn't work out. From Paris, I came up with what I thought would be a reasonable contribution to the script, and I amassed an enormous amount of coins and went to a public phone box near the Square Robiac, home address of James Joyce at one point, and called the late Colm O'Brien, the director, gave him the page and line references from The Unnameable, and did the same then with more coins to Barry McGovern. So the actor and the director were both aware of my recommendation, and it was adopted. I'm pleased about that. But that was the last input I had into the script. I didn't attend a rehearsal. I didn't meet with anybody. I was present for the opening night, and I was utterly gobsmacked. What Colm O'Brien did was sensational. Barry's performance, of course, was nonpareil. Bobby Ballas' set was absolutely a neutral space. And the lighting by the late Rupert Murray was enchanting. I was gobsmacked.
Well, well, so there's an audience. It's a public show. You buy your seat and you wait. Perhaps it's free, a free show. You take your seat and you wait for it to begin. Or perhaps it's compulsory, a compulsory show. You wait for the compulsory show to begin.
Michael Colgan has said, but what do you want for your contribution to the script of I'll Go On? And I said, well, I'd like a return ticket to Paris and a meeting with Samuel Beckett. Michael said, okay. So that was fine. In April the following year, 1986, was Beckett's 80th birthday. And I'll Go On played for two nights in Paris on the Boulevard Raspail in the Alliance Française Theatre. Barry played it. The audience was very receptive. Just before the first performance, the Gate Theatre group, of which I was a part, and so was my wife, because we were both there together, we were approached by Michael Farrell, the Irish artist, to say that he had met Beckett earlier in the day and Beckett sent us his best compliments, but he wouldn't be there. But we had already learned that his Dublin informants had told him that I'll Go On was the full shilling. After the second performance, Michael called and said that I was to be outside my hotel at 10 o'clock on the following Sunday. That's all he said. So I knew immediately what was happening. I was going to meet Beckett. So a taxi arrived with Michael Colgan, Barry McGovern, the late Rupert Murray, and space for me. And we went off and we arrived at the PLM, the hotel on the Boulevard Saint-Jacques, about 75 metres from where Beckett was living. Exactly at 11 o'clock, Beckett appeared in the Petit Café. Now, I knew I was going to be overwhelmed because I'd been reading this man since sometime in the 60s. I'd been working with this text for some months beforehand. Even tried to read him in French, which was a good idea too. He arrived and I'd had the presence of mind. The tables in the PLM are quite small and there was going to be five people sitting at the table. So I contrived to have my chair directly opposite where the vacant one was so that I could feast my eyes. So at some point during the course of the meeting, there was talk about, you know, touring theatre, and Beckett launched in on a description of the vicissitudes of touring theatre with Billy Whitelaw. She had done a tour of Australian venues with Rockabye and Footfalls, two late plays, two very quiet plays. And she'd been playing Rockabye in a theatre, I think in Melbourne, but it may have been Sydney, but a theatre. And in the ancillary small studio theatre. And on the main stage, upstairs, so to speak, there was a Vietnam War drama with, you know, helicopter gunships and machine guns and a raucous soundtrack by Bruce Springsteen. And she was playing this voiceover play, her voice, and she's on stage rocking in a rocking chair, Rockabye, it's called. And it's utterly quiet and it's utterly sotto voce and all this noise was going on. So Beckett said, apparently, the theatre was not sufficiently impermeable to sound. They're his exact words. And whatever look came across my face, he looked at me very, very directly. And he said, you've been looking at me very intently all this time. You haven't said much. What are you doing? I said, well, Mr. Beckett, I'm listening attentively because I want to establish whether your long immersion in Francophone culture since 1936-37 has inflected upon your use of the English language. Which was a bit cheeky of me. And he said, and do you think it has? And I said, well, to be quite honest, the way you've just used the word impermeable strikes me as very Frenchified. He said, oh, and why do you say? I said, well, you know, I would have said the place wasn't sufficiently soundproof. He said, oh, the word impermeable was all right for the master. And if it's all right for the master, it's all right for me. So I knew exactly what he was saying. The master, of course, would be James Joyce. And impermeable, the only place it could be was in Finnegan's Wake. So, of course, when I got home, I started Finnegan's Wake again, hoping that it would be near the beginning. Anyway, I found it in The Fable of the Mooks and the Gripes on page 45 in the Faber edition. And, of course, the word impermeable was used in exactly the way that Beckett had used. So I immediately wrote him a letter, apologising for being stupid. But I didn't tell him that Joyce had used it in the sense that impermeable is applied to waterproofs. Somebody is putting on their waterproof gear because you're going walking in the rain. I kept that back. The upshot of this was to establish an epistolary relationship with Sam Beckett, which was wonderful. I think I've had 7 or 8, maybe 10 letters from him altogether. And they're all handwritten. And they're all, at a certain level, illegible. Unless you work at them for hours and hours and hours. That allowed me, the fact that we were writing to each other, once or twice a year, allowed me to. And I knew that he didn't like to talk about his work, but if there was a little feature in his work that you wanted to quiz him about, he would be most helpful in replying. So there's a poem published in the 30s. The poem features a character who is cycling around the area of Yellow Walls, Malahide, Portrane in North County Dublin, in the, as I say, in the Yellow Walls estuary. And he's bicycling and he is pounding along in 3 ratios. And then after the word ratios, the poem begins a new line with the word Stürmer, which I wrote to Beckett and I asked him directly, did the word Stürmer in any way remember or register a memory of Sturmey Archer gears, which were a fairly normal provision on good quality bicycles, particularly on rally bicycles in the 20s and 30s and even later. And Beckett wrote back to say that Stürmer was Low German for warrior rampager. He had no recollection of Sturmey Archer gears, but he did remember the handlebar gear shift on his mother's old green machine, which is a very, very precious reply to get, because it allowed me to announce to the world that Molloy's bicycle was in fact based upon Beckett's mother's bicycle, because it was green like most of your generation.
Dear bicycle, I shall not call you bike. You are green like so many of your generation. I don't know why. It is a pleasure to meet it again.
This happens in June 1986. I was working in Limerick at the time. Our normal procedure in the summer was to drive across Ireland, get a boat across to Fishguard, drive across England. If the timing was good, get across the channel and stay in a motel on the way to Paris, because the normal procedure for me going on these holidays was to go en famille, the car packed, to go to the south of France, but to stop off for a couple of hours in Paris and have a meeting with Mr. Beckett. We left on a Thursday. On that day, in June of 86, there was a referendum in Ireland on removing the constitutional ban on divorce. As it turned out, my brother was the Minister for Justice at the time. So it was his initiative, so to speak, that brought about the referendum. The count began on Friday morning, and we set off from Clancy Strand in Limerick on the Friday morning in the car. Stay that night, in fact, we made it across to Calais and stay outside Calais. And then I always met Beckett in the PLM hotel in the Petit Café at 11 o'clock in the morning. And of course, he was always punctual, so there was no question ever of being late. I arrived, and I was there, and he arrived. And at some point, there was a pause in the conversation, and I asked him, because in the car on the way across England, FM disappeared off the radio, but it still had AM. But by the time we got to Slough, somewhere like that, there was no reception anymore. And the BBC didn't carry any report on the referendum result. nor was there anything on the French stations that was able to tune into on the Saturday morning. So having voted on the Thursday morning and then left on the Friday, now I'm in Paris, and I know that Beckett was in telephonic connection with people in Dublin. He would have been aware of the news from Ireland. So I said, "Did you hear the result of the referendum?" And he said, "Oh yes, it was lost." And then I was a bit taken aback, because as a liberal, I thought this is a cakewalk. Again, Beckett was looking at me intently, and he said, "Oh, you look very disappointed." I said, "I am." He said, "Were you planning to get divorced?" And I said, "No, I wasn't planning to get divorced. I was very disappointed because my older brother was the Minister for Justice. And I was disappointed on his behalf that he had failed to get the constitutional ban on divorce lifted." Of course, subsequently in the early 21st century, it was lifted, and Ireland became, the 50s ended, as they say, sometime in the early noughties of the 21st century. So Beckett, he put his glasses up on his forehead and he turned those amazing blue eyes on me. And he asked me a question. And the question was, "Are they all still asleep over there?" I was taken aback. I didn't know what to say. But a thought occurred to me. I said, "Mr. Beckett, did the adoption, the enactment of the Constitution in 1937, did it in any way contribute to your decision to leave Ireland?" And he said, "Of course, it did. Yes, affirmative." I remember on one occasion, must have been about 88, at this time I couldn't get a place to park close to the PLM. So I had to park up the street a bit and dash down to make sure I got to the hotel by 11 o'clock. When I got to the hotel, it was kind of extraordinary, because the Petit Café, which was just off the foyer of the hotel, was absolutely crowded with, it looked like, hundreds of Japanese tourists. And every one of them seemed to have a camera with a telephoto lens and a big bag of photographic equipment, and the place was a hubbub. There was absolutely no way that I could have had an encounter, a quiet morning coffee with Mr. Beckett, the Nobel Prize winner, in that cafe. So I went out to the lobby, because I was about 5 minutes early, and he came through a door that he never came through the front door. He always came in some trade entrance. He obviously had access to it. And he came towards me and he saw me. But he lost his footing. Those two shallow steps in the foyer. And he obviously forgot that they were there. And he was coming towards me to greet me. And I realised he wasn't going to see the steps. So I rushed up to him and he fell. And I caught him. Now, I'm not particularly bulky myself, if I may say so. He was as light as air. He really was like a feather. The last time I met him was again in Paris, but this time not in the PLM. It was in the nursing home where he stayed for some months before he died. He died in hospital. It was kind of a cheerless place. But Hugh Kenner was a Canadian academic, and he had written a very, very fine book about Beckett in the mid-60s. Joyce and Beckett. And the title of the book was The Stoic Comedians. A very, very good book. I met him in the PLM. He was staying in the PLM. prior to my going to Paris, I had reviewed Becker's recent publication, Staring Still. We got a taxi around to the nursing home, which was about 150 yards away. I had made the arrangements through a doctor in Dublin and an intermediary in Paris. And so he wanted to meet Hugh Kenner again because he was pleased with the book that had been written and so on and so on. We trooped into his room. There were only two chairs, one for Hugh, one for me. Beckett sat on his bed. Beckett, who had given up smoking, was smoking again. And I was still smoking at the time. And Hugh Kenner was a chimney. So there was a lot of smoking, a lot of talk. I had made sure I'd bought a bottle of whiskey. I knew Beckett liked his whiskey Irish. So that was opened and it was consumed in the while we were there smoking. And at some point, Hugh started turned to Beckett and he said, "Sam, did you read Jerry's review of your latest in the Irish Times?" Sam looked around at me rather quizzically. And he said, "No, what did he say?" And Kenner said to him, "He didn't say much. Stirring Still. We all know what it's about. It's about dying. But he did count all the words and noticed that in the first half, the sentences on average have so many words and in the second half, and that the word count comes out as a kind of fatidic date in your life, the year of your birth." Beckett turns around to me and he says, "Oh, is that what you did?" I said, "Yeah, there's always depths to your writings, Mr. Beckett, or Sam. You need to have your wits about you." So he got up off the bed and walked over to a wardrobe and he put his hand in and he took out a small object, which was obviously a book. And he came around and he handed it to me. And I saw it was called Soubresaut. And it's the translation into French of Stirring Still. And he just handed it to me. And I said, "Oh, thank you, Sam." And he said, "Will you study that?" And I said, "Of course I will. But I can tell you, before we go any further, that there will be fewer words and the patterns will be different. Am I right, Sam?" And he said, "Yes." But before we left, Beckett started to recite a passage from a poem by W.B. Yeats. Hugh Kenner chimed in with him, and the pair of them recited a paragraph from Yeats's poem, The Tower, and the pair of them went through this, and then, at the end, we shook hands and left. Never saw him again.
This time, I know where I am going. It is no longer the ancient night, the recent night. Now it is a game I am going to play.
He can be scabrously vulgar. And he can be lyrically enchanting. Sometimes within the frame of a single paragraph. His novels, his writings, his plays, they generate echoes and they offer you avenues of exploration which very few writers would open up for you. And they connect finally with being human.
Jerry Dukes there, remembering encounters with our featured writer this month, Samuel Beckett. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound and the producer was Kevin Brew. To listen back to this and Jerry's other commentaries, the Beckett season and hundreds of Drama on One podcasts, have a look at rte.ie/DramaOnOne. Along the way, you heard excerpts read by Barry McGovern from the CD box set Samuel Beckett Three Novels, produced by RTE and the Lannan Foundation in 2006, with Tim Lahan as producer. Next week's Drama on One is Write Your Mind, a play about youth mental health, devised by Jigsaw Offaly Service and Offaly Youth Theatre, with Eugene O'Brien as writing consultant and Angela Ryan-White as director. The series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds.
rte.ie/DramaOnOne